Hello, Freedom Nation. It's Jeff here once again with another episode of the Freedom Nation podcast. And on today, I've got Ian Noble. Ian actually sold a business, and in the process of selling that business, or actually before that, he had been buying some passive income investments, which helped him kind of transition from selling his business. So we're going to have a conversation today about what it's like to sell a business, what it's like maybe to be on the selling end of a buyer coming in, and a successful buyer in this case, we'll talk about. And then we'll talk a little bit about what you do after you sell your business, and you know, how fast you get going on that. And I think he and I will have a really good conversation. We had a good conversation ahead of time. So stay tuned. We'll be right back on in just 1 second.
Welcome to the Freedom Nation Podcast with Jeff Kickle. On this show, Jeff shares his expertise in financial and retirement planning from a different perspective. Planning for your Freedom Day, which is the first day that you wake up and have enough income or assets and do not have to go to work that day. Learn how to calculate what you need, how to generate income sources, and listen to interviews from others who've done it themselves. Get ready to experience your own Freedom Day.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Ian, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you on. And we are in the same town, so it's actually kind of fun to talk across town. I've had a couple people that were in the same town as I was in, and we'd never met each other, even being out networking. So,
yeah, we're right down the road from each other, it seems like.
Absolutely. Well, let's get started with your story. So tell us a little bit about how you got to where you're at today.
Sure. Yeah. I grew up here in Austin and had a family business. And so my dad had started a dry cleaners back in the 80s, and he had built that up. And after getting out of University of Texas, it was 2009, and the job market was rocky. And I was an economics major, so I was good at math, but didn't really have a skilled path in which way I'd head. And my dad approached me. I think he needed some saving, and he said, "Hey, why don't you give this a shot? Act like you own this business," because he wasn't working there anymore. He was just kind of burnt out and had stepped away from it. And so I got a lot of practice day one, going in, you know, learning from the bottom up. And fast forward a few years later, I bought the business from him.
Nice.
Went seven figures into debt and took on entrepreneurship. So luckily, though, it was a different style of transaction. You know, we still had lawyers and did all the process, but it was different because it was a trusted transaction. Mm-hmm. And so I built that up over the years and started, as you mentioned, you know, in the introduction, doing some real estate stuff along the way. So I've always loved real estate and still do. And then eventually sold. And so this is where I'm at today. I sold, started another company, and just having a good time, spending lots of time with my, I've got three little kids. So a lot of what I do now is based on the lifestyle of not going to be around my kids a lot.
Yeah. You can kind of design your life around the kiddos, and it's important at this point in their lives to be around them. So,
yeah.
So what did you end up starting up? What business do you have today?
So I have a private network where basically I will co-invest with people into private lending funds and mobile home parks.
Nice.
So these are, very cool. I look for opportunities that I like for myself. And then if they pass a ton of tests, then they get sent out to our network and people have the opportunity to get in.
Nice.
It's all passive stuff, so you're not running the day-to-day. And so that's conducive for a lot of business owners, parents with young children, like people that don't want to make real estate their main thing, but still want to participate in the tax benefits, the cash flow, the upside that comes with it.
And you run that was an LLP or an LP at that point?
Yeah, there's a couple of different structures depending on the deal. Sometimes we go in together as one LP, which is just, limited partner. We're on the passive side. But what's a little bit different about this versus just someone who'd normally invest into something like that, we're going in as a group. So my job, you know, amongst all the due diligence and the extra layer between the person who's actually running the deal and the investors that are in it, is to, you know, poke holes in it, make sure that the underwriting assessments are appropriate, and then have those conversations with the operator, background check them, put my own money in at first. I'm always the first investor in. So it's just really something I believe in and align with. And then the cool thing about that business is, and I didn't know this getting into the, before getting into the business, I thought, why does this role exist? Why would somebody not just go direct to the operator who's running the deal? Valid question, really. There's usually like fees that, you know, are eaten up when you think of a middleman, let's call it. Mm-hmm. But this wasn't the case. So I learned pretty quickly that it's tough to raise money and it's tough to get people into deals, and it's important to have this capital when you do it. And so by going as a group and co-investing, we get better economics and negotiate a better deal. So in turn, there will never be an opportunity for somebody to go around and find a better deal. So we don't want to penalize anybody from working with an additional person. I just treat it as like, hey, I'm an investor. I'm an advisor to you. Let's do this together as a group.
Nice.
And get a better return.
Very cool. Very cool. Let's talk a little bit. So that's almost exclusively what you do now is mobile home parks and things like that, or
private lending funds, mobile home parks. And that's on the passive side of my business. I'm also a real estate investor personally. And so I've been doing that since 2014. I have, residential rentals, commercial, properties here in Austin, smaller ones, land, and then a little, you know, some short-term rentals and things like that, but all geared around real estate. So I'm a landlord on my day to day. And then the fun stuff is getting to be the passive investor.
Yeah.
A lot less headache along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about that transition you made. So you'd started investing in real estate prior to selling your business, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So then somebody approaches you and says, hey, I want to buy the business away from you. You know, what was your plan at that point? Because, I mean, it wasn't planned that somebody was going to come out of the blue. But what was your plan after that?
So I didn't have a plan. And honestly, you know, I didn't feel that I needed one. I had done like fortunate maybe through, you know, through watching my dad over the years, he had set up other real estate endeavors. And so I think that's what allowed him to pull back from the business. And so I always had that mindset of have something working for me outside of my business. But the business was number one, right? Cash flow was the best. I made the most money from there. It was the most fulfilling. So, but I never thought about what's next. There was this goal when I had the business to, you know, build up my income from the rentals and then to someday meet what my annual income from the company, but it never made it that way. So company was doing well. And fortunately, we had, you know, a lot of good team here in town that was with us for, you know, many years. And so have kept that success going. But no, I didn't have a plan afterwards. It was a weird moment. You know, you walk into that closing office and it's everything that you worked. By the way, it took like over a year for this deal to keep you pieced together.
And it's hilarious. Yeah. You don't think, and especially you know, because you sold out, you know, to somebody here locally, but, you know, I sold out to a business partner, and I mean, it still took 8 months to get the deal done, you know, cause I mean, the attorneys get in and they fight back and forth and they just don't seem as motivated as you are. I think a lot of times.
Yeah. I was working a lot during that transaction because a lot, you know, you had the day-to-day stuff. I was very much an owner operator. And so hands-on in the business, I was taking stains out of clothes, everything, because I enjoyed it. And so at nighttime, that's when I would come back and, you know, answer the questions of the prospective buyer and gone through the whole process. Now, his background was in M&A. And so he was much more sophisticated. I had not sold a business before. So a lot of it, like, had a lot of questions. And some of the time was probably on me in the very beginning. I think he offered relatively quickly. And obviously, there's a due diligence period with that. But I kind of pumped the brakes and had to assess, am I selling myself short? Is there more upside? Is this a good deal? Some of the questions that I didn't know prior. And so that slowed down the deal a little bit.
What, you know, when you look back over the transaction, what do you think, you know, surprised you on the good side? And what do you think you would have done differently the second time?
You know, I'll say there are a lot of good surprises along the way. Some of the criteria that the prospective buyer needed, and now, you know, the owner now, were things that I had available to me, but I wasn't utilizing it from a business sense. Right. And so number one, it taught me a lot about running a business, ironically, that, you know, you wouldn't think somebody coming from the outside could teach you anything. But once you start getting asked these questions and pressed with, well, why did you do this? What is your strategy here? And sometimes, you know, in small business, you're just flying by the seat of your pants and you're making decisions that you know what to do with. And so that helped me a lot trying to figure out, how can I run my business better? If this deal falls through, should I continue to sell? Should I operate it now differently and set it up to where I have different structures or different personnel in charge? So there are a lot of questions, you know, internally that were happening during this process. But ultimately, like, my number one takeaway is to run your business like you're going to sell it, make it marketable, pull yourself out of the equation. That was obviously a big contingent point throughout that process, is like, what happens if you're not there? And, you know, I'm sure a lot of owners go through this. We have a self-inflated worth of what our duties are and our contributions to the business, where I had such a good team that the last couple of years, I think that I was the bottleneck in the company. Yeah. And we were at this growth ceiling of, can I break to the next level and make this, you know, a longstanding legacy for myself and my family, which could have happened. But the, you know, the turning point was, there was an emotional detachment at that point. I didn't know how to successfully pull myself out of the operation and keep, you know, good terms with key employees. And, you know, they're my family. You spend so much time with them. So that was really, for me, the turning point to where it's like, all right, I'm going to make this work at all cost. And it couldn't have turned out better.
Hmm.
So,
So you're the guy who bought your company. I mean, still running it and running it successfully. And
yeah, he's doing great. He, there was meat on the bone. So we were a dry cleaning company. There's a couple large players in the city, and our prices were significantly lower than the others, I would stack quality and customer service right there or better than those guys. Okay. And so for the new buyer coming in, obviously there was a couple price changes that honestly I should have done. But that was what's needed, you know, to kind of take, to let that next buyer, you know, build out his legacy within the business. He retained all the key staff. So that was a huge thing, you know, that transition and the trust. So I couldn't have asked for a more perfect buyer. I just came from a conference on business buying for people that are interested in getting involved in small business. And, you know, the number one thing is like, don't sell to those private equity guys. Like, it's a, you know, like, maybe you're taking a payout for the money, but it'll ruin the culture and ruin what you have built. Yeah. And so for me, it was personal. Like, I wanted the guy that was going to work it, that had good energy. And so, he was that person. It really worked out well.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like the perfect scenario where you found, you know, that right person out of the box to buy the company. So fantastic.
Yes.
So kind of from your perspective of what you're doing now, let's say I'm a business owner and I'm trying to figure out, okay, how do I start to diversify my world a little bit? And I want to get into real estate. What are, you know, if it were you doing it all over again, what would you do at this point in time in this market?
So I would, number one, take some sort of action to start building wealth outside your business. You know, you could be in a car accident, and especially if you're the key player in your business or a solopreneur, you're just one accident away from having nothing. And so I don't use that as a scare tactic, but in a lot of cases it's true, depending on like the staff count that you have. So get involved with something, and a lot of, you know, business owners, I would say that they trust in themselves, they reinvest in their business, but sometimes people will reinvest too much to where everything is in there. And, you know, even being a real estate guy now, I tell people, invest in the stock market. Stock market's done well for a while. I think there's a turning point that's coming there just because it's done so well for so long. But, you know, diversify yourself and reach outside of your business, because you never know. And same thing speaking to like a W-2 employee. You never know when you're going to wake up on a Tuesday and get that email from Amazon, Target, Oracle, you know, you name it, whatever's been happening this year for these engineers that otherwise had a great career. But you're working somebody else's dream. So in entrepreneurship, it's hard. It's not for everybody, but you have these options to, you know, really set yourself up in a good position. I also would say that, you know, part of what I do now and the reason getting into my business of, you know, helping my main, I guess I'll call it clientele, they're partners, right? Like, we invest together, are business owners. And so all walks of life. These are not real estate people. Some of them have a real estate background, but you know, we had on our last deal, a dentist, a surgeon, a restaurant owner, like just a name, you know, just spread it, you know, a veterinarian. Uh-huh. These are the groups of people that have money, have success, but don't have time. And so yeah. I wish that somebody 10 years ago would have told me about passive investing, because really I thought you had to buy property and run it yourself. I just wasn't aware of the bigger picture. Right. And then come to find out, you know, we live in Austin, Jeff. So, you know, you drive by any building along the highway and in mm-hmm. some form or fashion, that thing's been syndicated. Sports teams, apartment complexes, shopping centers, everybody like you and I listening in, or, you know, people listening in, $50,000, $100,000, and they're part owner, you know, half mm-hmm. a percent or something of a lot of projects around town. So yeah. I just didn't know about it. And so my job now, like for business owners, so many people sit on a lot of cash and they, you know, they're not knowing what to do with that cash, or depending on their tax circumstance, they may have a lot of opportunities for write-offs that their CPA is not telling them about. I'm not a CPA, so don't take my legal or tax advice, but there's real estate has some incredible tax benefits that, sure. you know, ordinarily wouldn't be available to, you know, to just having a job.
Mm, absolutely.
So I like sharing that with people. I like people who do really well, keep their wealth. And, you know, it doesn't matter what you make. If you're giving a lot back to the government or it's being taken in taxes, then, you know, don't you wish you knew a better way?
Well, and I mean, it's one of those areas that person who has a W-2 income, it's one of the places they can actually start to make their tax situation work a little bit more in their favor, because the tax system was not written for the employee. The tax right. system was written for the business owner or for the investor at that point. And so you've really got to kind of figure your way around that and make sure that you are taking advantage of the tax system instead of letting it take advantage of you.
And for business owners and W-2 employees, like once you see those benefits mm-hmm. that are out there for the taking, it's hard to unsee it. And so, you know, it's one of those things, if you know that you can offset a good chunk of taxes, again, depending on your situation, then it's difficult to be like, nah, I'll pay full price, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of my mission now. And plus I love small business owners because, again, that was my background. Yes, I've been in real estate for 10 plus years. On the active side, I do it passively. But I'm an entrepreneur at heart as well. Uh-huh. And so I think what's cool about being an entrepreneur, and I know, Jeff, you have several businesses. We all speak the same language. We all know, mm-hmm. we know what a P&L is, or should. If you're listening to this, you probably know what a P&L is.
Hopefully.
But behind your end product, you know, whatever that may be, we all have staffing, advertising, legal, leases, you know, mm-hmm. whatever our business landscape is. So it's just fun. I like helping people learn that there are better ways and better, you know, make better use of your money. Because if it's sitting, so many people just like sit on a balance for the comfort of their own mind in their checking account. I have friends that they're both high paid professionals, and they sit on regularly with six figures in their checking account. And I was like, why are you doing that? Well, we just always had this kind of this safety number. And you start asking questions like, well, what would happen if, you know, do you need $100,000? I'll pick 100 for an example. You know, how much do you really need if you had an emergency in month one? And then you start asking these questions, and then still they're like, we're just going to keep it, you know, keep it in there. So
yeah, it's just, I need that safety thing. Yeah.
And you know what? The bank's lending out that money.
Oh, so, yeah. That's, you know, how they make money.
They're playing the game with your money. Like, how does that make you feel? And so it's just kind of changing the mindset of people. And I've been having fun doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. You do have those clients, and I've had it in the wealth management, where they have a magic number in their head, and it cannot get below that number. Because if they get below that number, they start freaking out and, you know, oh my God, what are we going to do? Well, okay, what's your monthly expenses? It's like $8,000. Okay, so you've got like 2 years worth of money in there.
Yeah.
At this point, if everything went to hell, you'd still have 2 years worth of your income, expenses, and everything.
Which is so awesome for them. But it's, again, that teaching method of like, there is a better way. Whether, you know, and I'm sure you do this too, whether it helps your business or not. Like, I just don't like people making decisions that where they don't know what the other side looks like. And so that's been another thing in this learning curve. Like, I like real estate, and that's where my business is now. But I'm not going to be able to convince someone that is a low cost index fund, stock market 100%, you know, or whatever funds that they're in. You know, it's not my job to do so. So I'm happy that they are doing that. And it's, and because, you know, I do it too. It's a good thing to have money in, but point is spread it out. If you mirror and watch how the wealthy do it, it's not just sitting all in one spot.
No, and so, I mean, and a lot of times they use products like insurance and things like that as a means of, you know, basically I can build my own bank and not even have to worry about the banks. I can store money in there. I can borrow when I need to, things like that. So that's, you know, usually that's the step for me is like, okay, well, I know you get your magic number. Let's see if we can put your magic number someplace that'll actually do you some good for a change instead of the 0.2% you're making still on your bank account.
It's also a mindset thing because the wealthy look at like tax mitigation as a class of its own. So you don't need to necessarily pick, you know, whether you invest in single family houses or commercial property or whatever, tax strategy should be one of those. And if you focus at it that way, then there's lots of ways to make it pencil to where it's like, you know what, I'm reducing my either my taxable income today or future, depending on your circumstance. And I'm building wealth. So again, I like it. There's lots of opportunities out there for people.
Absolutely. So tell me a little bit about the deals that you're working on, some of this stuff. Is it relatively short term? Are they, you know, multi-year deals? What's, you know, what's the goal primarily for a lot of these syndicates?
That's a great question. So for my business personally, there are two things. So it's private lending funds and mobile home parks.
Yeah.
The private lending funds are kept open year round, and that's just a place for people to park their money. They earn 8, 9, or 10% depending on their level. And then that money's liquid as well, which is kind of cool. So a lot of people are used to like being locked in for a year or more, depending on that investment. So that one's always open. Think of it like a parking garage. And then when we present opportunities in the mobile home park space, nowadays it's called manufactured housing communities. So just to clarify, sometimes, you know, mobile homes have a stigma around investing. And so I would just tell people if you feel that way too, like I had family, in fact, ask me like, what in the world are you doing with trailer parks? I'm like, hold on a minute. This, you know, it's only because they haven't done it. It's the fear of not knowing what you don't know. And so point is the way those work, similar to like if you were to buy a house for yourself, you identify something, you make sure that it's the right fit for you. Obviously much different from an investment standpoint than like your personal home. But and then there's, you know, there's an option period, what we call due diligence. And then we bring that to market and they fill up quick. So within the network, there's usually like last time there was a waiting list and we filled up after 10 days. So these are good deals. They don't come often. Maybe there's a couple per year. And, but that's why I like having the lending fund that's open and the mobile home park is like when they come. And with the mobile home parks, you're an owner, you have equity and, you know, let's call it a percentage ownership. So you get the tax benefits, you get the cash flow. And but you're also prioritized as a passive investor, the way it's structured. So, you know, you get paid first is kind of the motto. Or if cash flow doesn't support your payment, you're still owed that. And so it's a cool strategy to where like it aligns the parties. Again, I'm a passive investor in them too, even though I work with them on the business side. So you can expect your money, to your question, to be tied up for, you know, 3, 5, 7 years, depending on what the strategy is. That's something if y'all are interested in looking at those, you should ask whichever operator you're talking to, like, what's your strategy? Are you selling this in 5 years? Is this an indefinite hold that you just want to cash flow on? Because you need to make sure, especially for business owners, if it's money you're taking out of your honeypot, you need to know, okay, do I need access to that? Is this the right thing for me now? Or do I park it and earn somewhere, you know, that's a little bit more liquid and flexible for what I need? So I think it's just circumstantial based on your personal needs.
Sure. Yeah. But I mean, a lot of times I talk to, I know business owners that have just, they'll sit on a ton of cash because they're worried about, okay, am I going to, you know, it's the same thing. It's that magic number in their mentality. And they'll have a ton of cash sitting around. Then once you present them with something outside of that, it's like, oh, wow, eyes open. You know, I have a client of mine, one of my favorite clients that, you know, he was sitting on, when I met him, he was sitting on like $1.6 million in cash. you know, we just put the money to work, really. And he was sitting there. We were talking last week. And he looked at me. He goes, boy, that $20 a year I was making on $1.6 million has certainly gone up since we've gotten together and started working together. So,
and it's so fun doing that, right? Like you help somebody that didn't know. He obviously made good money, or maybe maybe he did know, but you just got him over the mindset hurdle. So, and sometimes a benefit to that is showing people an opportunity cost. I think that all decisions should be made that way.
Yeah.
If you were to see that, okay, you know, you compare this percent to this percent, but the opportunity cost of waiting is X. Again, that's another one of those numbers that's hard to unsee. On your scenario with the 1.6 million, imagine I earned $20 in interest this year from my checking account, and you then compare that to what he should have been making and now does make, right? And you did him a service. And so that's what's so fun about this is because they don't teach financial literacy in high school. I wish that I think some start to, like, I know when I went, in fact, I checked on my high school, it's local here in Austin, and they do now. But they did not when I was there. And so those sorts of like basic understandings that you run across each day, like some people have no clue.
Oh, they're And I would say that, you know, my generation, probably through your generation. I mean, it's the younger kids I have so much hope for, the Gen Zers. I mean, they're one, the world has finally figured out, hey, we have to educate people on finance. Two, by nature, I think they're just naturally curious much more than other generations have been. And, you know, they're really starting to go, okay, well, I, you know, if I save now, this is what this can mean to me and blah, 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 blah. So it's interesting to see. And like I said, I have a lot of hope for that generation. My generation, we're kind of in the middle of, you know, hey, we were latchkey kids and we had to kind of figure it out on our own. So
my only fear for Gen Z or whatever the younger generations are, I don't know what they call them, is, you know, they have a lot of access and opportunity more so than ever in ways to make money that were what, you know, let's say your generation or my parents or whoever thought was unobtainable. But there's a lot of, you know, I'll call it fake news and crap that circulates the internet. And I bet you it's really hard, you know, because sometimes obviously like I'm in the business, so you can see something and you see a really high return. And my mind's trained to be the opposite. I'm like, there's something wrong there. That's not, but again, I'm a low risk person, but I can see that being really difficult for, you know, a 24-year-old that just got a big quarterly bonus. And they're like, man, I can earn 25% for this thing I saw on Instagram. Like I'm putting my money there.
Cause the guy was standing in front of a really nice house and a Lamborghini. Well, you can rent the house and you can rent the Lamborghini for less than $1,000, guys. So just saying. Not saying they lie or anything, but
funny story about back in the day at work. So I drive still an old truck and I would pull up to work and the staff, you know, we'd have BMWs and Escalades and like you were looking in the parking lot from the owner's side. I had to be careful because I was like, number one, I love my truck. But if I had to get a new vehicle, you know, ownership mentality is like, oh man, if I drive up in a new vehicle, what's the staff going to ask me for tomorrow? What do you think?
Yeah, exactly. Well, they got to pay for the BMWs and the Escalades and everything else.
It's just the thought process of a small business owner.
Well, and I mean, it's the reality. It's like, I laugh because, you know, I've been a wealth manager for years. I mean, if you look at me or you look at the cars I drive and all that, you know, you would never know it because I actually kind of don't like I love cars. I love them to death, but I will not spend money on them. And I've bought every car since 2001, I think, for cash. So, you know, I've not paid a loan on any car in years. And, you know, it's just the way I think and the way my brain's wired. Well, cool. Let's transition to the fast five questions. If you're ready.
Ready.
Awesome. All right, let's take it. All right, first question. You wake up in the morning. Business is gone. You have $500 in your pocket, a laptop computer, a place to live, food and clothing. What are you going to do first?
I think in that scenario, you stick to what you know. And if you're strapped to that capacity, you go and you find a profitable business day one. So I was a service business guy. I would probably go buy a power washer and start doing an ad or two or some free post and go power wash some doors. So I would start with something that's familiar, that's quick, has a quick return. at $500, you're going to be the one working for a while. So plan on something that get your hands dirty and go for it.
Love it. Love it. What's your biggest business mistake you've ever made?
Not partnering. When I was younger, I was selfish and I wanted everything for myself. And I passed up a lot of opportunities that in two ways. So, you know, people think about like, okay, you missed an opportunity. That means like there's some sort of money that was left on the table. But I think I missed a lot of wisdom. And so in my next, you know, in what I do now, I look for the smart people, the smartest people that I can find that run it. In my next business, because I'll, you know, have another business someday, it'll be who can I find that's the brightest person in the room? Mm. How can I hire a talent and pay for a talent? Uh-huh. I think that I was, stingy along the way and thought, well, I can cut if my expenses and wages aren't, too high. But now I see the benefit of companies that really pay their staff well. Mm. And then it alleviates burnout as well. So it's two-sided, right? You can stay in the game a little bit longer.
Yeah. Awesome. What's a good book that you'd recommend for our audience?
You guys have probably heard these books before, but for good reason. So Who Not How is a very good book.
Okay.
And Who Not How teaches you, you know, as an entrepreneur, you are ready to do everything yourself. And mm-hmm. when there's a problem, you are the fixer. And so that really reframes your mind to assess every situation and how can you get somebody else to do it for you. So it's that was kind of eye-opening for me. Second book, I know you didn't ask for two, but I'll give you two. I like Buy Back Your Time. Buy Back Your Time is another one. It puts a dollar amount on your, on what you do in the day to day and really helps you align with, okay, do I need to be doing $10 task if I think I'm worth $500? Mm-hmm. And so it actually helps you calculate how much you feel that you're worth per hour. And then the idea is if you can stick to it and you can sub out for anything that's under that amount, you do it because the productivity that you're giving up and the opportunity cost is costing you more than you know.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That's a great, good couple books. And we haven't always, we've heard them a couple times, but not in a while. So you came forward with some good ones. What's a tool that you use in your business every day that you might recommend?
I use a virtual assistant that is very helpful for me. They're in the Philippines. They treat them like almost a partner of the business, but handle to what I was just saying with the book analogy, like I put a price tag on my time and uh-huh. she helps me and is incredible and much better at things that, on the admin side than I would be. Yep. So I would look at outsourcing, look at fractional employees. If you have an HR, HR people, look outside and you can take advantage today of a lot of fractional positions that would be really key to your business at a fraction of the cost.
Oh yeah. Well, and I mean, you'll be amazed at the caliber of talent you can find. Sometimes it takes a little, it takes a little bit of work, but I think it's also, especially if you've not had employees or haven't had a lot of employees, it gives you the chance to practice a little bit in what I consider a lower risk situation. One, from a cost standpoint, and two, if they really suck, you just let them go. You don't have to keep hiring them. It's not like you have to sit there and look them in the face and say, okay, we're going to fire you and you've got severance pay and all that. You're done. When you're done, you're done with them. Yeah. You cut the cord and you're fine. So it gives you the chance to build the right kind of team. And a lot of times I go into that when I bring somebody on like that, I give them a project and see how they work on that project. And if they've done well, okay, maybe we'll keep you on for the next project after that.
And it's still a task in itself. You have to manage your virtual assistant or executive assistant, whatever their role is, and spend time with them because you want them to understand your business. You ultimately hope they become your voice, or at least they think like you to some degree when they're handling
this.
It's
like Monica that runs this podcast. I mean, she's my podcast producer. She's worked for me now for probably 4 years. And, we've gotten to the point now we can kind of finish each other's sentences and she works independently, which doesn't require me to manage her a lot. She gets it done. I don't have to, I don't have to think twice about it at that point. But there are still times where, she'll kind of go off on a tangent and I'm like, whoa, let's pull this back here a little bit. I didn't give you enough guidance on that at that point.
Yeah.
So it's no different than hiring somebody here in the States and somebody that works for you in person. I mean, you can't just let them go, hey, go clean some clothes and, you know, not really give them any guidance on how to do it.
That's right. Yeah.
Cool. Last question. What is your definition of freedom?
Freedom's the ability to wake up on any day of the week and you pick your schedule. So you can go for a run. And I can tell you, as a business owner, I used to be that person that would look at everybody, you know, let's a delivery driver quits and I'm out driving my delivery van and I'm looking around and I'm thinking, what are these people? It's Tuesday at, you know, 10:30. Like, why is everybody out playing at the park? So my definition is
Ian, cause they're working from home. Oh, yes.
Yeah. I have friends and I'm like, how can you do it? So yeah. I understand why there's a push to get people back into the office.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would be freedom to me, the ability to pack up, take vacations, and kind of define, you know, it's a time measure. It's not a money thing. You've probably interviewed a lot of successful people on your podcast. Uh-huh. It's never a dollar amount that they think they're going to get to. Because even if you obtain that goal, you want to go, you know, it doesn't change your life. And so
finding a lot of times if I always use the thing I heard from Bruce Springsteen, he's when you make more than $5,000 a day, you have more than $5,000 a day problems at that point. So, you know, it's just because you have a certain amount of money doesn't mean you're free. Just because you run your own business doesn't mean you're free. I mean, you've got to really understand what that freedom means. And it is that ability to go, you know what? I don't want to go to work today, you know, and you don't, you know, and I, in four of the five businesses I own, I could do that. One, I can't right now. And that'll be the one that we have to figure out a way to unwind and get out of, because I want that ability to be able to say, hey, I want to jump on a plane and fly someplace and I can still work while I'm there if I need to.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Beautiful. Well, Ian, thank you for being on. Thank you for sharing your story with us. If somebody's interested in learning a little bit more, maybe they want to get into passive investing, what's the best place to go?
Thanks for asking. What I'll do for your listeners is I've put together basically a cheat sheet for passive investing. So it'll help business owners who are curious about it look at to see what questions should I ask? Mm-hmm. What does the process look like when I start to get in to the world of passive investing? Just to try to cut through the nonsense of what's out there on the internet. This is applicable not just with me, with anybody. So I just it's a good read. I'll share the link in the show notes.
Beautiful.
And then also my website, runsteadyinvestments.com, or you can connect with me on LinkedIn. Probably most active on the channels there. So just search for Ian Noble and you'll find me on there.
We'll put your information in the show notes so they can find you on there.
Okay. Click the link.
Click the link. Yeah. That's all you got to do. But Ian, thank you for being on. Thank you for sharing. And we'll catch you on the flip side.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Beautiful. Well, folks, as always, make sure that you click the subscribe button if you haven't already. And if not, or if you have already done that, well, then let's give us a thumbs up or a comment. So thanks a lot. And we'll see you guys back here the very next time.
Thank you for listening to the Freedom Nation podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and all the major channels. Wherever you're listening, please subscribe to the channel and leave a rating and review. If you have friends and family that could benefit from their own Freedom Day, please share with them. Finally, join Freedom Nation by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.